Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current events in China coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm joined as usual by Jeremy Goldcorn, man behind Danwei.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser.
We've got a trio of terrific journalists as guests today. Mary Kay Magstad, correspondent for Public Radio International, is with us. Great to see you, Mary Kay.
Good to see you too, Kaiser.
Looking very tan. Have you been somewhere warm?
I have not. Oh, it's an illusion.
The Beijing sun or something. We've also got Tanya Brannigan back this week to talk about a great piece she wrote that just ran in the paper, The Guardian. Thanks for coming by to hang out with us, Tanya.
Thank you.
And finally, joining us is that now famous slayer of mendacious monologuists, Rob Schmitz of Marketplace, up here from Shanghai to speak of his journalistic exploits. Great to have you here on Seneca, Rob.
Thanks for inviting me, Kaiser.
And Rob, my lad, I have to say you have come a long way from the days when you used to write for ChinaNow.com about having earwax removed by an old codger in a park in Chengdu.
I can still hear much more clearly now.
Good. I need to have that done. I need to make a trip to Chengdu because my left ear is just... So today we're going to chat quickly about the turmoil at the top here in Beijing following last week's dramatic removal of Bo Xilai from his post as Chongqing Party Secretary. We won't spend too much time on that. Then we're going to look at demographic change in China. Tanya has written about the major challenges that China will face as the first major economy to really go gray before it gets rich. In a country where filial piety isn't just a value upheld by Confucian culture or whatnot, but it's actually a practice backed by force of law, what is this all going to mean? And finally, we are, of course, going to talk about L'Affaire Daisy with the reporter who broke the story wide open, with Rob here. I'm sure that all of us are very curious about how that whole process took place, and so I invite all of our guests here to throw all sorts of questions at Rob.
Please don't interrogate me too badly.
Well, we're going to make you cry like
okay.
Mike Daisy.
Okay.
First of all, let's talk about the turmoil here at the upper echelons. A fundamental, if unwritten, rule of Chinese politics, and this really goes back, I think, to pre-communist times, has been that you just always present a facade, at least, of unity. And visible splits at the top have always been very much frowned upon. They've been taboo. But many are saying that that is exactly what we're looking at right now, a leadership split, the likes of which we haven't seen in 20-plus years. Let's start with Mary Kay. What evidence, if any, do we have of a schism that goes beyond at least, you know, just the obvious dismissal of Bo Xilai, which was made public? Is there anything to these rumors about the purges of prominent leftists or to Zhou Yongkang being in the doghouse or, dare I say, rumors of a coup d'etat here in Beijing?
Well, we've certainly heard that some of Bo Xilai's supporters have been detained or are being investigated. His wife is being investigated for corruption. In terms of how many other senior cadre, senior officials, are also going to be taken down or are being investigated at the moment, we really don't know. It's a very opaque system.
In the spirit here of really, you know, being factually accurate, do we know that Bo Xilai's wife is being investigated for corruption?
Well, that's a good question.
Right. I mean, we have that just basically on the evidence of this tape, right?
Right. So there was a tape that was leaked online, and I use the word leaked somewhat loosely because we assume from the context of the tape, from what's being said on the tape, it sounds like it's from a meeting of officials in Chongqing. The person who's speaking has a strong Chongqing accent, giving an account of what happened between Bo Xilai and, you know, basically the entire incident that led to him being removed. And there's a lot of detail. So because of the detail and because of the context, I think there's an assumption that it probably or at least could be a real tape,
right,
which of course raises the question of why did someone leak it? These sorts of things don't just happen. You don't have someone who, you know, just sort of sneaks their iPhone into a government meeting and then releases the tape online unless someone thinks it's kind of okay for that to happen.
Hmm. And so just for our listeners who haven't read about this, Barbara Demick wrote about this in the LA Times and also included a transcript of key sections of that tape. So we'll put a link to that on the site. Now, a tale that you know, everybody's been hearing is that the very things about Bo that endeared him to Westerners, to Western journalists especially, are exactly those same things that have worked against him. Tanya, do you
mean that he actually has a personality?
Right, exactly. That he's
self-aggrandizing, populist.
Yeah. I mean, that's the the short takeaways.
He would have been a good mayor of Chicago.
Yeah, he's sort of a glamorous kind of guy. He's a little more flamboyant. I mean, we always use the word flamboyant now. It's like swift-footed Achilles, flamboyant Bozzi Lai.
And there's this long list of comparisons, everybody from Silvio Berlusconi through to Huey Long that's been thrown his way. I'm tallying them with some enjoyment.
Oh, really? Okay. You must present us with a full list of all the analogies that have been drawn for the guy. So, I mean, do you think that this was it? That he was the Chuho Niao, he was the bird that stuck his head out, that he was sort of hammered down because he was out of character? Or do you think this was a fundamental policy disagreement with the others? Or do you think that it was just chiefly about his having interfered allegedly with a corruption investigation into his family? Everyone is like daisy shy now.
It's all speculation. Let's be honest, it's speculation and none of us knows. I'd say sort of in China, it's a classic, those who know do not speak, those who speak do not know. Although, as Mary Kay points out, one of the interesting things with some of the material we've seen emerging is it seems like somebody is, if not speaking, at least trying to hint.
Right. And of course, Wen Jiabao hinted in his news conference last week that, you know, we don't need any more cultural revolution antics. You know, we're moving on a different path now. We're on the path of reform. We're going to continue on that path. And to say that when he was asked about Bo Xilai's case suggests that, you know, he was taking a bit of a swipe at him and saying, you know, we don't like what you were doing, even if you were doing it just to try to curry favor and gain attention so you could get a position in the standing committee. Not good. You know, we think it's a dangerous path to walk. And, you know, once you unleash some of those forces, you know, you can have unintended consequences. Right. We don't want that.
And I think it's logical to assume that if somebody that senior has gone, there's going to be something of a ripple effect. It's not going to be something that happens completely in isolation because you don't get to that level
without having
that kind of profile,
exactly,
unless you have connections. But how great
how far will
the repercussions are, we don't know. And I certainly think, I mean, we've seen this extraordinary amount of chatter, particularly on the microblogs.
Let's talk about these
rumors.
Most
of which seem to be entirely unfounded, as
exactly,
far as I can tell. I've had some very late nights sort of picking them over, and there really didn't seem to be anything behind them, almost
so,
the point where you wonder if people are stirring things up.
Three seasoned reporters in the room with us right now, and then a couple of amateur China Watcher types. Has anyone seen anything that's decently sourced about the events of Monday night?
No.
Okay, neither have I. So where is this all coming from?
So one thing I can say as an eyewitness point of fact is that on Sunday I saw an unusually large number of police on the southern side of Tiananmen and the road that led east from there.
Okay.
Dozens, possibly more, close to 100 or more. And it just seemed unusual, and they wouldn't talk about why they were there, and no one else seemed to know why they were there. Could have been something else, but it was just a day before the supposed coup.
Right,
so maybe there was
hardly
heightened
like
security
of, right.
for some reason.
Right.
I mean, there was heightened security for some reason. We just don't know what the reason was.
You know, but what we're hearing are, you know, reports of gunfire. We're hearing reports of tanks. I mean, but this all seems to be complete.
As far as I'm aware, I haven't seen any first-hand reports of gunfire for a start, or even first-hand claims. I mean, not even reports, but the sort of material of speculation was, you know, people say there's been
and
gunfire,
the pictures
which
of
is a very different thing. The pictures of
turned out to be
old.
A fake.
I mean, they were from,
from 2010
from the
rehearsals.
Right. So when in fact there were tanks.
And then there was a North Korean delegation visiting Zhongnanhai on Monday night, so there could have been a heightened police presence around that.
It could have been the reason for the
it could have been the reason for the ones on Sunday during the day, yeah.
Yeah, and following the way that the Weibo chatter unfolded on Monday night, because I was watching it at the time, it seemed as if it started with the activity around the guest house, which was from the North Korean nuclear negotiator, and then people started throwing a bunch of random stuff together.
Okay.
So basically, we have to conclude with a quote from Bob Dylan, right? Something's...
The answer is blowing in the wind.
There could be a lot of quotes from Bob Dylan that would...
A lot of
everybody must get stoned.
Everybody must get stoned is perhaps the most appropriate one. But I was actually thinking of there's something going on here, but we don't know what it is.
All right. Anyway, let's move on from that. Actually, there's one more thing. This whole thing has been bothering me at one level, which is that we've all come to sort of accept this sort of simple heuristic about the way that factional divisions have played out in the party. That we think that there's this Communist Youth League faction on the one hand and this Princeling faction. We've all agreed that this is probably grossly oversimplified, but hasn't this whole Borsilai affair just thrown that out the window now? I mean, here we have, you know, the Princelings are supposed to stand for damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead modernization, coastal heavy, don't worry about income inequality or anything like that, while the CYL faction is supposed to stand for more social leveling, more hinterland development, and blah, blah, blah. And here we have a princeling, Borsilai. I mean, you cannot have a more royal pedigree than him. And yet he seems to be, very much on the left. The Chongqing model is clearly sort of a populistic model. I mean, doesn't this just sort of, how do Cheng Li and the others who have advanced this basic understanding, I mean, is it worth thinking of in those terms anymore?
I would say, maybe there are factions or splinter groups, but maybe not along those lines, or maybe not primarily along those lines. Perhaps it's more that some people are more in favor of an authoritarian, centrally controlled state with a very strong state-run sector. And others are saying, we can't continue with this model that much longer. We're running out of gas. I mean,
right.
there was just news out today that for the fifth consecutive month, the manufacturing sector is contracting.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of other signals that the old way of trying to grow the economy just isn't really working very well anymore. Wen Jiabao has many times over now been talking about political reform, unclear what he means, unclear what he thinks should happen, if anything. But there at least is a sense among some people in the leadership, it seems, from what they say, that they'd like to see a certain loosening up and allowing allowance within the system to have checks and balances so they don't, have such a risk of going off the rails like Borsilai just did.
I mean, I think in some ways it goes back to what you just started with. I mean, it seems like because Borsilai had a personality, because he was so, like you said, flamboyant, right? I mean, this almost seems like a war on personality in some ways. If you look at the leadership, right, if you look at Hu Jintao and the leadership in the last 10 years.
Safely, bland, pablum,
exactly.
Colorless.
And I think that the party wants to keep that image up, because I think any personality starts to scare a lot of the leadership into thinking, or a lot of maybe the people into thinking, okay, we're taking a step backwards here. We've seen this before. It's not been pretty, and the results are not good.
Yeah, and I, for one, actually like the blandness. I mean, I actually think of the consensus-driven nature of the leadership to be not a flaw, but a feature. It's not a bug at all. I mean, I think that it's actually one of the better things. And, there is that sort of whiff of demagoguery about a guy like Borsilai.
What do you think, I'm just wondering, what do you think, like, the Lao Baixin think about this? That's kind of what I'm thinking about. What are they saying about this? So, I mean, a lot of people probably don't even know who Borsilai is when you go into the hinterlands.
Maybe down in Shanghai where you live.
Some of the postings that have remained online, a lot of them have been taken off, have still been pretty supportive of Borsilai.
Right.
And, there are some accounts of people having pitched up in Chongqing with signs in support of Borsilai, although that's also been taken off fairly quickly.
Right. And there were all there was all discussion recently about leftist websites being silenced and Twitter accounts, or I'm sorry, Weibo accounts of prominent leftists.
Yeah, what was it, Euphoria?
Utopia. Which
Utopia.
Is, I think, my favorite Chinese website, actually, is the Maoist website Utopia, which is really a wonderful, fascinating, they're some of the most interesting people who actually publish in China in a way because they have opinions. And they went offline on the Ides of March, on the 15th, the day when Borsilai went down.
Suspiciously.
And I, at the time, actually thought that they were just being cowardly and, they basically weren't sure whose ass they should be licking at that point, so they just decided to shut up. But they then said that they had been contacted by somebody telling them to delete everything that they'd published about Chongqing, which is believable.
Yeah. I would just say, Kaiser, that, I'm not sure that it's such a bad thing for there to be leaders that have a personality as long as they play within the rules. I mean, I think that's really what Xi Jinping was saying in his article in Chosher in the Communist Party Journal that came out last Friday was, we don't need someone who steps outside and doesn't go through the Central Committee, doesn't like run things past us, who thinks he's got his own little party and can do things his own way. For the system to work, we all have to agree on how we're going forward together.
I mean, is this a bit like the I'm a freedom fighter, you're a guerrilla, he's a terrorist? So, I'm a free thinker,
your loose cannon.
Well, exactly, running pretty much along those lines.
Sure. And
he's a dangerous
demagogue.
But
when you look at Bo Xilai, you know, someone who, when he was in Dalian, was this, you know, Western-friendly capitalist pro-business guy who goes to Chongqing and starts singing red songs and talking about how great Mao Zedong is.
Well, his son is famously driving a Ferrari.
You can't search for online anymore. It does call into question, you know, how much political integrity does this guy have and how much can you trust him if he's given any more power than he already has?
Yeah, I think it also sort of demonstrates the difficulties of calling him a leftist, though, or seeing this as a sort of left-right split. And I guess the other thing, I mean, the point you made about whether it's control, slightly more relaxed control in a marginal, what we would consider to be a very marginal way, probably, is a good one. I mean, we tend to sort of think about there being left and right in politics or so forth. But, I mean, very often there's not one pole.
That's right. I mean,
you can split people in different ways within any political system.
Absolutely. I think that's the lesson to take away here, that it's a whole lot more complex than some of us would have us believe. Let's move on. I mean, in the interest of time here, there's so many interesting topics to get to. And talk about Tanya's piece. I mean, family planning policies in China have been in place now for, close to 30 years now. You know, at least policies that compel urban families to have only one child. These policies have arguably helped China to avert some kind of Malthusian nightmarish scenario and apocalypse there. But there are all sorts of social, economic, and even political problems that China now faces as a result. So Tanya has written a very nice substantial piece in The Guardian about the rocks in China's developmental road. I have to say that the accompanying video is outstanding, and everyone should make sure to watch that because it features some amazing athletic feats by some very old Beijingers, and it's truly humbling. You see these like 80-year-old guys doing multiple pull-ups and swinging on monkey bars.
Well, one of the guys, as he was dangling upside down, told me he only started when he was 73. So I like to think there's hope for us all.
There is hope for us all.
Wow.
Now,
where did you shoot that, Tanya?
Yeah, where did you shoot that?
Ditan Park.
Go
up for yourself. They were all very lovely and very chatty and quite keen to talk. So I'm sure they can probably show you the route if you're trying to sort of improve your fitness regime.
Now, so
they
the
can
opening
possibly give you some tips.
The way you lead visually with that video is very different from the way that you lead the actual written story, though, where you talk about the very tragic story of one He Daxing, who's an octogenarian from Chongqing, who spends a shivering New Year's Eve on the stoop of one of his six children, none of whom will take him in. Tell us a little bit about this. What is particularly illustrative about this case, and what does it say about China's shifting demographic landscape and about, you know, the changes in attitudes and values toward the elderly?
I mean, I think it tells us, firstly, that there's an expectation of the elderly being treated well here. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I think you might argue that was the link with the start of the video, which is that in many ways, China's quite a good place to get mm-hmm. old. Mm-hmm. People are active, they're integrated, they're generally quite well respected. In many ways, when I compare it to the way that old people are often treated in the UK, it's quite humbling because you do see a lot of old people kind of being shunted off into a corner and being quite isolated in the UK.
In America, they don't just do that, but they laugh about it on The Simpsons, right? I mean, that's one thing that's always bothered me about The Simpsons.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of funny to laugh at old people and grannies and marginalize and discriminate very often against older people. So there's this expectation that people will be treated well here. And in a sense, because what happens in the case of He Daxing is that the neighbourhood committee then comes along and says, do you want us to help sue your children? Because in fact, under Chinese law, there is an expectation that if you're capable of doing it, you should be supporting your parents.
Talk about this law. I mean, this is a national level law.
And it's I think the point is not that it's literally enforced. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, clearly in some cases people seek to. Ultimately, it's very difficult to force people
to
look after
their
parents.
Right.
But the point is it's there and it's intended to, I think, send that message. I mean, there's also been proposals of creating another law to say children should even visit their parents, which is on a regular basis, which is what I would say was even harder to do. So, I mean, it's partly there as a sort of a moral flag. I guess.
Know, it's bad enough that every year we're subjected to Chong Hui Jia Kan.
That's a fairly new law, too, isn't it? It's like in the last 3 or 4 years.
I think it's relatively recent.
And I think passed in response to the fact that...
Exactly, yes. In fact, what used to be regarded as absolutely standard and would not have been questioned is now something that's clearly not being practiced in some cases. I think I've talked maybe last time I was even on about Yan Yunxiang's book on life in a Chinese village, which is brilliant. And one of the things that was very shocking to me when I first read that is when he talks about cases of elder abuse. In some cases, old people kind of being relegated to these sort of back bedrooms and made to feel that they can't join the family at the dinner table. They have to kind of creep out afterwards to sort of eat whatever's left over. In other cases, people being physically hit by their children or in-laws. And so, as I said, while in many ways I'd say China is still a better place to be old, perhaps than many places in the West,
I guess
there's clearly a real
forward,
breakdown in a lot of these family relationships.
That's right. Before we plunge forward, let's get a grip on some of the numbers here. I mean, we've often heard about the 4-2-1 situation. How does this actually play out statistically here in China in the next 20 years or so? I mean, we've got this gigantic demographic bulge right now of people, you know, my age, people in their 30s and 40s who were born before the one-child policy in the 60s and the 70s and are now sort of aging out of the workforce, right?
Oh, but if I can just jump in, there's also a huge bulge from the 1950s when Mao was encouraging mothers to have lots of kids.
Sure.
Right.
So they're the ones who are edging close to retirement right now. And
so it's a sort of multiple problem. It's actually not just about the birth control policies. It's about the fact that there was a sudden bulge in the population because Mao sort of thought as a matter of national security, everybody should be breeding as enthusiastically as they could. And then you see this very sudden drop off. It was going down anyway, but then the drop off becomes even more sort of sharp with the introduction of the one-child policy, which, of course, was only supposed to last for one generation. Mm-hmm. And this is what we forget when they announced they were going to continue it. It wasn't really continuing it. It was renewing it.
And when you've got 500,000 people involved in the family planning operation...
They have a vested interest in
keeping
it.
Exactly.
And I think there is this real fear. It's interesting. I mean, the one thing that we have all heard endlessly is, you know, China has too many people. And there is that sort of perception that the problem is too many people, but actually what's becoming increasingly obvious is that it's really about the shape of the population as well. And so as you say, China's benefited from all these young workers, but they're starting to get older. There's going to be fewer people moving to the workforce. You've got this huge number of older people from the 50s.
Is there any sense about when, because, you know, Japan's going through this right now, and this is a big deal in Japan about, you know, whether they, you know, how many people can emigrate to Japan. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of immigration issues there that, you know, they don't want too many immigrants. When will we see this play out, do you think, as far as, you know, we're not going to have, enough workers?
Right. So, I mean, this is a sort of international problem. But the real difference with China is that China hasn't developed. It hasn't become a developed country. Usually the problems kick in when you reach a certain stage of development. And in China, because of the birth control policies, it's happened much earlier and it's also happening much faster. So people say 2, maybe 3 times the pace at which it's happened in Europe or in somewhere like Japan. So although Japan actually has a much lower birth rate, China's facing the problem much earlier. And we're now looking at probably something like 12 or 13% of the population being over 60. But by about 2050, it's going to be something like 30, 34, 35%. So it's going up very, very fast, and it really doesn't have much time to adjust to that.
And Japan had a nice, tightly woven social safety net ahead of this, and it was a rich country before this population problem.
And so, I think, you know, China's going to have to do something about its retirement age, obviously.
That's one of the solutions.
Is it 50?
55.
Yes, 55. Right. Yeah, it's quite early. And obviously, I would imagine they're going to be looking at that very soon.
So would that solve fundamental problems, Tanya, or would that just push off the day of reckoning by a decade or whatever?
Well, I think it will help. I mean, the other reason that the population is aging is the very positive thing, which is people are living much longer, which is great, you know. entirely to be encouraged, obviously, but it does sort of have the side effect. The problem is, of course... As politicians everywhere have found, even though everybody's living longer, nobody wants to spend those extra years of life in work. So raising the retirement age is usually extremely unpopular. But that's one of the ways in which they can tackle this problem of what would otherwise be a shrinking workforce. And there are other things. There's a lot of underemployment. You can improve education levels. There are lots of things
to
do.
Move to a different economic model. Not relying so much on manufacturing, where there are already hundreds of thousands of jobs standing empty. But move to a higher value added, more social services oriented economy.
Easily said.
And in answer to partial answer to your question, as soon as next year, there are going to be fewer people going into the workforce than there are retiring.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it as well.
The last note I would say is that I read Tanya's article. I loved it. And she managed to find an 88-year-old, I think, who had a 109-year-old.
Oh, that was great.
Mother, is that right?
Yeah. And I mean, this is the amazing thing, actually.
How do you find these people?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I went to Evergreen and I sort of said, you know, so why aren't the kids sort of living with the parents? And they said, well, in one case, our oldest resident is 109 and her son's 88 and he can't look after himself anymore. So
the woman you had in the video at Evergreen was amazing. This woman who was, you know, very much against the common mold. She had a couple of Harvard graduate kids with advanced degrees from Harvard, all working in jobs and saying, you know, I refuse to be one of these people who insists that my children take care of me. Evergreen, talk to us a little bit about this. I mean, is this retirement industry booming? I mean, is the stigma against putting your aged parents into a home, is that starting to erode in China?
It's starting to, I think. There's a couple of things. One is that a lot of overseas firms are now trying to move into the Chinese market because they see this fabulous opportunity. And so a lot of people are exploring. You're starting to see some high-end care homes being built, or in other cases, they're trying to do things like home care to get over the stigma of care homes. They're offering caring services within somebody's home. And the other sort of interesting point that they made is if you can sell care homes or care services as a high-end quality good, it becomes something to aspire to. It's no longer a loss of face. It's not about your children shunting you off. It's actually about your children saying, I love you so much that I want you to have the best in life. Does that have a trickle-down effect? I don't know.
Indeed, often I think, this is just anecdotally, in talking to parents who are now in their 50s or 60s, I've heard quite a few over the last few years say, I don't really want to live with my kids.
Yeah.
I like being on my own. I like being with friends my age. They understand me.
Lady at Evergreen, exactly.
Kind of annoying.
I don't want to babysit my grandchild.
And they certainly don't want to do all the childcare because they've been there before.
Yeah.
So do you think that the government is taking the necessary actions at this point? Do you think that there's an awareness across the leadership of the urgency of this problem?
Well, the 12th five-year plan is the first one that really looks at aging as a problem. But the point that Wang Feng of the Brookings Institution makes, and he spent a long time looking at this, is that they're sort of doing it with one hand tied behind their back because they're talking about the things they need to do to cope with an aging population, but they're not addressing the issue of birth control policies at all. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, I mean, there's also a big question, really, if you lift the birth control policies at this point, how many kids are people
really
going to have? You're not going to see it rebound completely.
City dwellers, certainly not.
Yeah, I mean, an urbanizing population, I would imagine.
Exactly.
We're not 50%.
There was a pilot project, or there is a pilot project that's been kept quite quiet in southern Shaanxi, where families were allowed to have two kids. And once they were allowed to have two kids, they didn't really try to have a third. It's like, you know, that's enough. That's what we want.
And you only need to have it at 2.1.
And a lot of the experts have pushed for two-child policy.
Or just let people have their kids. You know, some people have three, some will have one, some will have none. A lot of only children are like, why would I want to have kids?
Are you talking about freedom?
Well, it's worked in other countries. You know, the birth rate has come down naturally.
You appear to be in the wrong country, Mary Kay.
She's always been a very subversive force, I feel like.
She is. I don't know why I keep having her on this show. I'm going to get myself in trouble. Let's move on to our third and final topic for the evening. Let's talk about Mike. Daisy, for those of you who have spent the last week living in the deserts of Namibia off of the grid, one of the most commented on stories was, of course, the American radio program This American Life's retraction of the episode Mr. Daisy visits the apple factory. Is it goes to or visits? I can't remember.
Mr. Daisy goes to China, no?
No, the apple factory.
Anyway,
the very, very talented monologist Mike Daisy tells the story of his investigation into labor conditions at Foxconn, which, of course, is one of the main suppliers for Apple. They make things like the iPod and the iPhone. Rob, who's sitting across from me here, of course, was the main man whose skepticism over certain details of the story and subsequent his reporting really convinced This American Life host Ira Glass to devote a full hour. This is unprecedented to the matter in an episode that was called Retraction. Earlier today, I was online chatting with Arthur Kroeber, who's been a guest on the show a couple of times, and he described that show, listening to that, as, quote, the most excruciating listening I have ever enjoyed. I have to say, I completely agree. It was just serious cringe fest. Oh, my God. I mean, every muscle in my body was just bunched up. But anyway, he saw that I had changed my status message on GTalk to, I feel like I have the normal worldview, which I think if anyone's listened to that, was the killer line that Ira delivered in that. Anyway, Rob, can you take us back to where you were and when you first heard Mike Daisy on This American Life, and what was your immediate reaction to this?
So I'm a subscriber to This American Life. It's one of the only podcasts I subscribe to.
Besides
Other than Seneca. I was listening to it, I think, a week after it aired, the Daisy episode. And I was actually listening to it as I was getting ready for my day. It was a Sunday, I think. And I was sort of passively listening. And the first thing I heard is the way he frames the story. I don't know if you guys remember this, but he says that all of our crap isn't made in China. All of our crap is made in one city,
right, which
Shenzhen.
Is already wrong.
and I thought to myself, what is he talking about? And so that was the first thing. But then I thought,
he could have said Dongguan, and I would have said,
maybe,
okay.
I thought, okay, maybe he's just exaggerating, and you know, I don't really, you know, who is this guy? I didn't really know what was going on. And then I heard the portion where he gets to the gates of Foxconn, and he sees these guards. He says with guns.
No, he doesn't just say with guns. He says carrying guns,
and they look pissed.
Right.
And you know, we've all, I think, been to factories in this room here, and I've been to several factories in my reporting here with Marketplace. And you know, the thing that you usually see at a gates of a factory is a security guard that's half asleep holding a jar of tea.
A Nescafe.
You know, you would never see a security guard holding a gun. And you know, because in China, obviously, you know, the military, the police are allowed to carry guns. Sometimes you see the armored vehicles with the guns with, I think
shotguns,
rubber bullets,
right?
Maybe. Yeah. So, but you didn't even see that, right? So I think there were a lot of things in that story that just didn't ring true to me.
Right. And so what was your next step? I mean, how did you actually get in touch with This American Life, and how did you end up having this commissioned?
Well, it was kind of convoluted because after that, I talked to a lot of other reporters here in China and you know, over email about, you know, what is up with this episode? And we were all talking about this. And a lot of people thought it was just sort of all bogus, and we, you know, there was a lot of conversation happening over email and in my social circle. Then my wife and I, my wife had a baby.
Okay.
and we were. I was
so on, obviously, you had nothing else better to do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was on paternity leave, and I one day it all came back to me, and I listened to it again. I thought, okay, the only other character in this monologue, her name is Kathy, and she's in Shenzhen. So I went over to my computer and I typed in Google Kathy and translator and Shenzhen, and I looked at the results, and it was I called the first number that I saw. I didn't click on anything. I just called the number. I turned my tape recorder on, and it was her.
Amazing. So now, how did you actually approach This American Life then? I mean, with this smoking gun.
Okay, so I went down there to talk to Kathy, obviously, and discovered that
this is actually before you've contacted TAL, right?
This is before, okay. Yeah. This is actually I told my editors. I said, I'm going to Shenzhen. I think this is an important story. You'll hear from me after I get back. And I went down there, brought a copy of the monologue with me because it was, I think, the day after that he made it available free for download. Mm-hmm. Brought the printed copy to the gates of Foxconn, where Mike Daisy and Kathy went. By the way, there were no guards with guns. And we were there, and I went point by point in the monologue, and I discovered that most of the details in this monologue where Kathy is present, according to Kathy, didn't happen. So at that point, you know, I wanted to really confirm all of this because I was trying to be – I wanted to be really careful about this. I asked her, okay, I need to see emails between you and Daisy. And so mm-hmm. she provided those, and I got basically pinned down their itinerary. I went home. I typed up a memo that was probably 15 pages long.
Wow.
After doing a lot of research on Daisy himself and how many media appearances he made, because I think that was an important thing. He was in the media quite a bit ever since this started running in New York. And then sent the email and handed it off to my editors. And there was a lot of discussions amongst my editors. And they decided, they came back to me and said, I think we're going to do a piece for Marketplace, which we did, which was the one that broke the piece. Mm-hmm. It was on Friday afternoon. And we've talked to This American Life, and they're interested in devoting an entire episode to this. And so you'll be working with Ira Glass.
Wow.
For listeners who actually were in Namibia, you might want to explain who Mike Daisy is.
Okay.
And
I didn't know who Mike Daisy was until I listened to this podcast, into This American Life podcast. Mike Daisy is a monologuist. He's basically a storyteller, and he's been doing this work for many years, and he's very good at it. His latest work is called The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, and it's about his obsession with Apple. And part of it is also about his trip to Shenzhen to discover where these products are made.
Where all the products that we use apparently are.
Right. And so in that portion of the monologue, he goes to the gates of Foxconn. And then he says that he meets workers from a secret union. And he also says that he poses as a businessman and goes to all sorts of factories and sees dormitories and assembly lines and workers. And so he gives his impression through this monologue. Now, the key here is that he has told people that this monologue is true and that he actually saw these things.
Right. I mean, there's a difference when he's standing on a stage doing it in front of an audience in a theatrical setting, I think. And when he – very, very clear. I mean, I think that Ira makes this perfectly clear. He tells them that this is going to be held to journalistic standards, they go through the efforts at fact-checking the story, but he actually deliberately deflects, right? He tells them, for example, that the name of the translator is Anna and that she has a cell phone number that no longer works, right?
Right. Well, This American Life, as a requirement for taking this and devoting an entire episode to it, wanted to fact – they basically said to Mike Daisy, look, we're going to fact check it. You say this is true. We're going to fact check it.
Perhaps at this point I could just ask for a definition or an explanation of This American Life, because Americans love it, but most people who are not American don't know what it is.
This American Life is a weekly public radio program that is distributed throughout the country.
By WBZ in Chicago.
From WBZ in Chicago. And it has a very passionate devotion from its audience. When people hear this, they don't passively just listen to this show. They are very, very, they're huge fans of this show.
Yeah, I mean, I've sat in my driveway and listened to it many a time. I mean, just, you know, coming home from a trip in the States, that is.
And he has a passion for long-form storytelling.
Exactly.
But Ira comes from a journalistic background. He was at National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. He worked for Morning Edition and All Things Considered. So he brings that sensibility to the storytelling when it's a story that's like this one.
Right. And so this, I mean, and he's also, Ira Glass, of course, is a great storyteller himself. And, you know, that's what this American Life is really devoted to.
What really struck me about the fact checking, I mean, Ira sort of does this mea culpa on the air in the retraction series. But they talk about having contacted like 13 people, and he's like, you know, when we couldn't get a hold of the translator, we should have pulled the story. But I'm thinking, you know, in more than 20 years of journalism, I have never had an editor ask me, excuse me, we need to contact your translator to make sure that what you reported is actually true. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a very high standard that he's holding himself to. Obviously, it would have helped in this case.
It would have helped.
But the puzzling thing to me is that there were just so many. I mean, if he had asked any journalist working in China, I mean, does this check out? Does this seem to
that
be plausible?
Yeah,
to, I mean,
sure.
I mean, I don't think anyone would have just – it would have passed the smell test with anyone. I had a good half dozen people that I talked to who are in the profession – who just smelled a rat. I mean, but none of them jumped.
The same episode with Daisy had Nick Kristof, who was a New York Times correspondent in Beijing for years. So, you know, obviously he had heard it.
Well, no, I don't know if he'd actually heard the monologue.
Oh, perhaps. I mean, okay, maybe he didn't hear it. Yeah,
Kristof offers, I think, a very, very good balanced sort of, mm-hmm. A counterpoint to it. I mean, he talks about what the alternative would be, that these women, I mean, I think he kind of tells it like Leslie Jong would have told it, you know, about this sort of grand adventure that is, you know, leaving this life of brutal agricultural existence and going to the city mm-hmm. to work. Anyway, I'm more interested in hearing how you know the whole process of you. What was it like to actually? You didn't sit in a room with you were in a remote studio. I understand when you talked to Daisy himself. Or did you reach out to him first, or was that part of this process?
So after it was agreed that I'd work with This American Life, you know. When you work for This American Life, you do a story for This American Life. Ira really works with you. He's very accessible, and you work with him every single day. I mean, mm-hmm. you're calling each other all the time. Because Ira had spent a long time with Mike Daisy adapting this monologue for radio, he had already developed a relationship with him. And Ira felt that he was going to make the call to Mike and tell him that a reporter from Marketplace has some questions for you about the veracity of your monologue, and I want you to come in tomorrow, and we're going to talk about that.
Wow. And he agreed to do this, knowing full well that...
Well, he did, and I think that, you know, the backdrop here is that, you know, This American Life in many ways helped make Mike Daisy, for at least public radio listeners in the United States, which is a very large audience, and also just a very tuned in audience. It made him a household name in some ways. So, you know, I think Daisy realized that, you know, Glass vouched for me. So I think I need to come in now.
Okay. And I mean, the rest is we've heard it on tape. We know how.
Many people have heard it.
The audible squirms and just that those long, long, uncomfortable silences that he just cannot answer.
And the extraordinary. I was supposed to say the extraordinary euphemisms as well, as he tries to find various ways to say that he wasn't really making it up.
Right. So let's bring this back to a discussion about China. I mean, was there something in Mike Daisy's mind that made him think that China is just so far away, so exotic, so, I mean, inscrutable to the American listening audience, that there's just no way anyone's going to doubt the truth of what I'm saying?
I think there was a bit of that. I think there was a bit of exoticism on his part, mm-hmm. Obviously. He came armed with stories that he had read. And when he went to Hong Kong, before he went to Shenzhen, he talked to labor activists who were giving him, obviously, you know, labor activists do great work in China, but they were giving him the extremes of what was happening across the border.
Sure.
And so he was, I think in many ways, he came across the border, he came into China with this education. And it seems to me, at least, that he was looking for these things. Mm-hmm. And perhaps when he didn't find them, he just made the decision to make it up.
Well, and then he explains to Ira that he was sort of doing this for the greater good, that in order to really touch people's hearts and get them to care, you know, he had to blur the edges a little bit of what was reality and what was just, you know, an illustration of something that he had read about before, which was also reality, just not one he had encountered himself.
That's right, Mary Kay. And he seizes on this, in fact, and carries it to kind of a ridiculous length in his Georgetown speech, which, I mean, the guy is incredibly thick-skinned. Thick in other places too, maybe. But unbelievably, I mean, he just gets back up on his feet after what would have had me on suicide watch. I mean, I would have been just so devastated if something like this had happened in my life. But a couple of nights later, he's on a stage in Georgetown giving a talk, essentially, defending himself and really seizing on this point that Mary Kay just raised, that he's doing this for a greater good.
I mean, this is a global problem, but I think you encounter quite a lot of it in the United States. I mean, you know, at the same time that this has been happening, there's been the Kony 2012.
This is exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, right.
It's very similar in some ways.
No, there's a ton of similarities.
When I watched the Kony 2012 video, the first thing that struck me was you see the guy, the main guy, whatever his name is, in Uganda.
Jason Russell.
Is it Jason Russell? And he's talking to the young boy who's one of the heroes of the YouTube
Jacob,
film.
Right.
And he's like, so, he adopts this accent that I've heard Americans in Africa use to speak to Africans because they think it's easier to understand. So,
do they take your brother away?
You know, oh my God.
And when I heard that, my first reaction was, what is this? But I think it's a symptom of a kind of a problem with Americans who go into the world to do good.
Yeah, the missionary impulse.
It was very much the white man's burden, it felt to me, and the point you sort of make about exoticization. It seemed to me the whole kind of gist of it was, how will I, Mike Daisy, save these poor Chinese victims from their terrible experience? And instead of actually sort of thinking that the workers maybe have ideas of their own, I mean, the idea that Chinese workers have never considered how they could improve their factory conditions, are you kidding? They usually have a very long list. I mean, the interesting point a labor activist was making to me was saying, increasingly, it's not just that they know the law and they can go through the law and say which bits have been abided by and which bits haven't, but they will also say, you know, and this is what we should be entitled to, that people are much more aware of what they regard as being civilized working conditions or what they think culturally should be taken account of and so forth. So the idea that these people are kind of wafting around, and I also think, you know, if you don't listen to the people, you come up with the wrong solutions. Is this really about Mike Daisy saving Foxconn workers, or is it also, in addition to the responsibilities of American consumers, whether Chinese workers should be able to organize and talk about their problems?
That's a really good point. I think, you know, it's interesting. I've been interviewed by media in the United States and in Europe throughout the last week. Every night, I've you know, had different interviews at different parts of the night because, you know, we're 12 hours apart from the East Coast in the U.S. And the questions sort of baffle me a little because people are asking me, well, because generally these things have happened somewhere that he's talking about, does it really matter that he lied about them? I've gotten that question over and over.
From people who are journalists, ostensibly?
These are American journalists. Wow. And I think, you know, for us here in China, that it's sort of cringe when you hear that question, right? Because, you know, really obviously, you know, it of course it matters, because this man has not only done a theater performance about this, but he's actually gone out to the press. He's reached out to the press. He's allowed journalists to treat him like a journalist. And he's then told these lies that he claims he saw these things and he didn't see them. You know, it definitely matters because he's shaping a public perception about China. And it's a very simple one. It's a very black and white one. When the reality, obviously, as we all know here in this room, is very complicated.
And even if you hear his words and are moved and want to do something, what do you actually do? And I think that's another similarity with the Coney thing. Is,
right.
Okay, I've given my $30 for my Coney pack or whatever, and what difference is that going to make in the life of even one African? And so far, we haven't seen any evidence.
Let's go back to what we were just talking about with, you know, lies in the service of the truth. Why does it matter, these lies? Tanya, you linked to a really good piece in the Los Angeles Review of Books by Jeffrey Wasserstrom, who was a guest on the show just a couple of weeks ago. I don't know, Jeremy, did you get a chance to see that?
Yes,
I did.
And he makes, all of us got a chance to see this. I mean, he makes a very, very interesting comparison to the incident on June 4th, 1989, where, you know, it has come to be called the Tiananmen Square Massacre, and points out that, in fact, it's actually not even a matter of much dispute anymore, that, you know, large numbers of students were not crushed by tanks in the square itself, that the killing happened outside of Tiananmen Square itself. And while this may not seem to matter to some people, it actually has – well, I mean, so I think, Tanya, maybe you can explain it better than I can.
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, firstly, the most obvious thing is that our job as journalists is to inform people. And when we tell them things that are wrong, we're misinforming them. And that means they're not understanding the situation correctly. So that's sort of the most fundamental thing. And then that also leads on to questions about whether you come up with the right solutions, if you're looking for solutions and so forth. But the point that Jeffrey Wasserstrom also makes is that these sorts of errors are then used to discredit the broader points, the fact that a huge number of workers was actually shot dead. Were actually shot dead on that night. So the fact, and these things are used to deflect, to criticise, to suggest that people are lying in a broad sense.
Undermines the authority.
And I mean, we've already seen People's Daily today had this piece suggesting that it was a sort of deliberate. It wasn't accidental. rather oddly, given that This American Life devoted an hour to retracting it and that Rob dug this up in the first place and that they cited people such as the New York Times criticizing Daisy, they then kind of drew the conclusion from all of this that actually it shows that the Western media sort of don't care what they say about China. They have such a negative stereotype and they'll kind of happily, to promote their worldview, will keep wheeling this sort of stuff out. I mean, a totally illogical piece, but it shows the dangers, basically.
My takeaway from the whole thing was that, the best outcome from this is that people will question reporting about China that just slots in too comfortably with the received narrative, whether it's about human rights or labor activism or labor conditions or whatnot. The worst thing about this is that people will question the reporting out of China because it comfortably slots in with the received narrative. So he's done a huge disservice, if you ask me, to the very cause that he purports to support.
The thing that I guess looking at how the media is handling this in the U.S. and how they're broadcasting this, the issue here is that most of the coverage of this is being devoted to Mike Daisy. Mm-hmm. It's not being devoted to actually what he purports to be standing for, the Chinese factory workers. You know, I don't see much coverage about that at all. It's all about him, which is, would suit him very well. It seems to be kind of, if there's anything that would be good to come out of this, it would be stories about, you know, what is it really like in these factories? Maybe we can just open up this debate again and talk about it a little more and try and delve into the complexities of this issue rather than talk about Mr. Daisy some more.
Let's everyone give one final thought about this matter, and then we got to move on to recommendations because we're running long this time. That shouldn't be a surprise. But Mary Kay, your summation of Fair Daisy?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a summation, but just one further thought, and that is, I think Mike Daisy really underestimated the American listener or the American consumer of news and information, and the confrontation between him and Ira Glass, the host of This American Life, really highlighted this sharply, where Ira said, when you tell me you saw something, I believe you saw it. I believe that what you're telling me is that this is a fact and you saw it. And he said, well, you know, that could be one worldview. We could have different worldviews on this. And Ira said, I think I have a normal worldview.
Right.
And I think that's true for most consumers of news. If you're going to a film and you know that it's being presented as fiction, you're not going to believe everything that's in the film. If you read a novel and you know it's fiction, you're not going to believe everything in the novel, even if it's a historical novel. If someone's presenting you with a news story and they say, I stand behind this story, this happened, if you trust the source, you believe that to be true.
That's right.
And if Mike Daisy gets on This American Life and tells Ira and tells all the listeners of This American Life this is true, listeners have a reason to believe it's true, and they want to believe it's true. They want to know they can trust that news organization or that media organization, rather.
I think you're right for our generation. However, what I've found when I've been looking at the coverage of this, there was a very interesting article about someone had written an article, and I can't remember it right now. But they interviewed a journalism professor in the United States, and he talked about this issue. He played the This American Life episode to his journalism students, and his journalism students didn't see why this was such a big deal.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
And when I read that, my heart sank.
Yeah.
My heart just sank when I read that. I read that actually on, you know, coming to Beijing. And
welcome all.
I couldn't believe that. And he was shocked. The journalism professor was shocked himself. It's very interesting how this new generation who's been brought up on the internet, you know, getting all their information from blogs in different places, right, where you're not sure what you can trust, how they see this. I think it's fascinating in some ways.
Kids these days. Tanya, one last thought on this before we move on to recommendations?
I think I'm so depressed by that observation.
Very
I don't even
depressed.
Know what to say next.
Sorry.
We can move on to Jeremy then if you want to put the capstone on this.
I don't know if I'm the right person to put the capstone on it, but I, as somebody who has lived in China and has occasionally been quite critical of Western press coverage, I mean, I think it is another example of the fact that one can continue to get away with talking all kinds of crap about China and not having it questioned. And I mean, the internet has made it more difficult. The fact that This American Life is a podcast, not just a radio show, means that you know, Rob could do this work and this whole thing could happen. But I think it is still a big problem, and especially in the US, where most news is really focused on America, and a lot of, you know, if you don't go out of your way, you don't get international news. So, you know, is China run by like three-headed monsters who eat babies? Yeah. You know, a lot of people would find that believable.
I must leap in my colleague's defense here and say it's often striking, though, that usually the errors or the really appalling pieces that make one bury one's head in one's hands are not written by people in China.
That's right.
They're written by people flying in Mike Daisy style.
I'm going to say it again.
Absolutely. I wasn't intending to criticize the foreign press corps.
The press corps here is pretty darn good.
Outside now.
I mean, it's a prestige gig to have a Beijing bureau job here. I mean, or Shanghai too, right? Shanghai is also
thanks,
prestige.
Thanks, guys.
Let's end the conversation about Mike Daisy there. And let's start with some recommendations. Jeremy, what you got for us this week?
A blog that just launched, I think, today by some friends of this podcast, notably Will Moss is apparently behind it, although he hasn't written anything. That's Image Thief.
Jeremiah Jenny.
Also Jeremiah Jenny, who's also been on this podcast. Brendan O'Kane, who occasionally works at Pop-Up Chinese and does many other things.
Translator Parks Long.
Who's Jeremiah's wife. And who's the... Dave...
Dave's gone China, right.
So Dave Lyons. Bunch of heavy hitters from the foreign blogosphere in China have got together and made a new site, rectified.name.
And it's very funny. In fact, the first article that Brendan wrote has a very direct connection to this whole Mike Daisy affair. Jeremy, you read that. Right. I mean, I was going to recommend that today, in fact.
Well, sorry, I beat you to it. And yeah, so Brendan wrote about how basically Mike Daisy's bullshit is really very, very boring. And if we're going to have bullshitters bullshitting about China, could they please get more interesting and perhaps get back to the
Edmund Backhouse.
Edmund Backhouse.
Right. Like grand, huge, about being sodomized by the Empress Dowager Cixi with her ridiculously outsized clitoris, right?
That's right.
Yes, that's what we want. Mike, listen carefully. Tani, what you got for us this week?
A new book by Jonathan Fenby, who, of course, has been writing about China for many years, coming out in April, called Tiger Head and Snake Tales. And I think particularly for people who are maybe newer to China, but for the rest of us as well, it just offers a very nice overview of where China is now and some of the issues it faces. And Jonathan's always very good at kind of pulling all these strands together, but doing it in a very readable way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I've been looking at is a book called Deep China, which tries to look at really at some of the ways that the individual is changing in China as China changes. And I think that's one of the fascinating things being, again, with demographics and filial piety, that you're talking about these kind of huge sweeping changes involving hundreds of millions of people at a time. And then on the other hand, there are these very personal decisions and the real anguish people feel about, you know, will I look after my parents well enough, and can I bear to live with my in-laws, and all this sort of thing.
How is it so far?
Pretty good.
Okay. Do you happen to remember the author's name?
Arthur Kleinman.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Who teaches medical anthropology at Harvard. I took his class.
Wow.
Which was called Deep China.
Oh, well, this is what started it off, yeah. Wasn't it, I think, that it sort of came out of the... So should I continue reading? Was it a good class?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. That's great.
Excellent. Rob, what do you have?
Wait, before Rob, I think just because Tanya's here as the only other member I know of the Beijing Azure-Winged Magpie, so Appreciation Society, I think we should just
the official
have
mascot
little,
of Seneca here.
Yeah, another little recommendation of the Azure-Winged Magpie.
Okay, we're going to do this every time now, I guess. Let's just, like, at the beginning of the show, I'm brought to you by the Azure-Winged Magpie. Rob, what you got for us?
Well, we had some really heavy topics today, so I decided to bring an article that is quite lighthearted. It was written last week by my fellow Shanghai journalist, Adam Minter, from mm-hmm. Bloomberg View. He wrote, I thought, what was an excellent article about Asian carp in the United States and the Chinese blogosphere lighting up, watching how the Obama administration is going to be investing a lot of money right now into trying to fight the widespread kind of proliferation of Asian carp in the Great Lakes region.
When, in fact, what they need are better recipes.
Exactly.
We'll eat those guys.
And there's so many people saying, wild carp? Why would you want to kill them and not do anything
with
them?
You say wild carp, I think shui du yu.
So it's a great article, and I would suggest everyone to read it. It's excellent.
Thanks. And Mary Kay, what do you have for us?
Well, since we've been thinking a lot about power these past few days and abuse of power, potential abuse of power, and because the subject of this book did win the Confucius Award this year, I'm suggesting or recommending The Man Without a Face by Russian journalist Masha Gessen. It's a fantastic book. It's also really depressing, really chilling about Putin's record in Russia.
Wow. Okay. Man Without a Face.
The Man Without a Face.
Wow. That's an eerily titled book. I'm going to recommend something quite good, but a little more sort of down to earth. It's an interview with Richard McGregor, formerly of the Financial Times here in Beijing, and Damian Ma, who writes for The Atlantic occasionally, and will actually be visiting Beijing soon. I'm scheduled to have a drink with him. It's a really good interview by Charlie Rose, master interviewer, and it's all about the sort of power struggle here going on in Beijing, or the supposed power struggle, and I think they talk some very good sense about this. Please check it out. We will put that and all the other things that we've recommended, as well as articles we've referred to, on our podcast page. Please visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SinicaPodcast and follow us on Twitter at SinicaPodcast. Thanks very much, Jeremy.
Thanks, Tanya.
Good to see you, Tanya.
You too.
Rob, I'm really glad you could come up for this.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Mary Kay, as usual. And so we will see y'all next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.